My name is actually Devanesan.
Devanesan?
Devanesan.
Devanesan.
And short form, well, half of my name is like what they call me at home, so that became my name.
Okay. Mm. So where are you from? Give me
Kuala
a little
Lumpur.
Of your background.
Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia.
Okay.
And background, okay. I'm 56 years old now. I've got 4 children. I'm divorced. What else do you want to know? I went to school in Malaysia.
Okay.
And I did what is equivalent to A-levels. Have you heard of A-levels? No, it's based on the British university or education system.
Mm-hmm.
So after A-levels, you go to university.
Okay.
So I did A-levels and then I joined the Merchant Navy. I was in Merchant Navy for about a year and a half.
Navy as in on the boats?
Yes, worked on a ship, yeah.
Okay. What did you do?
I was a navigation officer. Okay. Actually, I was a cadet. I was under training.
Okay.
After the training, I stopped.
I
didn't want to carry on in that career. But after that, I worked as a volunteer for an international non-governmental organization, you know, known as NGO.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's actually an American one, sort of like church-based, but they were all over the world. And, you know, they had community programs in many parts of the world. And I was kind of very keen to do that kind of work. This organization is kind of like research-based in the sense that they go to communities to do work and at the same time they document all the learnings. And that way they really could improve themselves and improve the methods which they used.
Mm.
A lot of it is based on communal lifestyle, you know, what they call corporate living. And you know, they go into a village or a small community and do a consultation. And in a week or two with the local people, they would develop a 2-year plan on, you know, making improvements to the village in all sectors. And it's always comprehensive, you know, they don't focus on one area.
Mm.
So they would do social work and education on health, developing business, all on a micro scale, you know, on a small scale,
mm-hmm.
on a local level,
mm-hmm.
and you know, introducing local technologies, you know, things that work. We call ourselves like catalysts, you know, we're not really doing the work, but you know, just being there to make sure, you know, whatever they plan.
You're helping the progression along.
That's right. So that it was they themselves were really doing it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was really great because, you know, for once the whole community got together to plan and, you know, it kind of engaged them. And they, you know, they really saw that there are many possibilities, you know, on what they could do to an event like that.
Mm.
Mm.
So,
yeah.
What did you do after that?
Well, I was with this organization for 4 years. Of the 4 years, I spent 2 years in India, in villages in India, because, you know, there are projects all over the world. But I got ill when I was in India and, you know, I just didn't feel like I could carry on, you know, I had malaria and, you know, we had to work at the local level and, you know, we didn't have proper health facilities and so it was very, very kind of unbearable for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to go back home. So when I went back home, I started applying for work and I got a job. The first job I got was as a reporter with the Star newspaper. So, you know, I started like from the ground up, you know, as a cadet reporter, they call them.
Mm.
And they put us in a training program where they taught us, you know, all the tricks of the trade, doing interviews, you know, what kind of questions to ask, how do you write an intro,
right.
You know, the inverted pyramid structure of news writing. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I know it pretty well.
Yeah, and
What is the censorship like for the media in Malaysia?
It's pretty bad right now. Yeah, it's controlled actually, the media.
Yeah, can you explain how, in what way?
Well, it's like this. It's what the media people call self-censorship. Because in Malaysia, you can't, there are certain issues, you know, you can't really talk about, like, things having to do with race, you know, you are supposed to avoid that, and religion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But these are very hot topics because they are very everyday issues which everybody in the society faces, you see, but not supposed to write about that. So the editors basically know that, and they all the reporters would know that because, you know, they keep telling the reporters this, you know, what you can write, what you can't write. So that's self-censorship, you know, so you don't really, you know what you can't write about, so you don't write about it.
Mm.
That's what it is about. So, and also, the other thing about Malaysian newspapers, the mainstream media, as they call it, is that it's most of the news, most newspapers and electronic media there is owned by political groups. So they're all aligned, you know, to whichever party owns them. So, and obviously they would just report things which are positive about those organizations, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, if there is a certain issue which is very relevant, you won't get to see very much of that, you know. So, I would say that, you know, what you read in the newspapers is not a true reflection of what's really happening in the society there,
mm-hmm.
in the mainstream media.
Is there like underground publications or kind of like indie independent magazines, newspapers?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Well, not in print so much, but in the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So they are playing because there's such a thirst and hunger for the real news. You know, a lot of people go into the internet to get their news,
mm-hmm.
which gives a very good coverage of what's really happening, and a lot of. You know, it has been said Malaysia has more bloggers than most other countries in the world, you know, because there's this kind of oppression of free speech in that country. Everybody turns to blogging, you know, and you can say whatever you want. So it's created a huge number of bloggers in that country, and you know, everybody wants to have their piece to say. And these bloggers are very popular in Malaysia, you know, people read them and. You know, they give feedback and comments. Everybody wants to have a say, you know. It's very interesting to just read the comments which people make based on what the blogs are saying, you know.
Yeah.
It really has gives a reflection of the real mind of the people there.
Yeah.
Which you don't see in the newspapers, which are edited and censored and, you know, the whole works,
yeah. Yeah. We have a lot of bloggers in the United States, too, and sometimes it becomes problematic because of legitimacy and stories being kind of passed down and down and down, and it becomes so indirect that sometimes you don't know how much truth is behind it. So, although it may not be censored, it still may not have that same legitimacy.
Yeah. Well, I think in a case like that, there must, you know, like they say, there's no smoke without fire, right?
Right.
And you have to read these kind of items with that in mind, you know, there must be something behind all that. For people to say those things.
Right.
So, I think most people are wise enough to know that.
Yeah.
You know, when they read a news item, you know, they can probably guess, you know, or have an idea how far, how true this, whatever they're reading is, you know.
Mm.
You kind of develop that sense, don't you, as you go along? It's good, too, as well, because it develops your sense of discrimination. I mean, in a positive way, because, you know, you need to be able to sift what is right and wrong, good and bad.
Yeah.
You know, make evaluations like that, you know, and judgments like that, yeah.
So how did you come to Oroville?
I've read, you know, a little bit. I've been kind of like a seeker, you know. I read a lot, I've been reading a lot. And so it was interesting, and you know, I heard that this guy Aurobindo was a freedom fighter, and you know, he fought against the British, you know, to try to find independence for this country. And I had, you know, when I was, remember I said I was quite ill and I wanted to go back home. During that time, I had to go back by ship, you know, because I couldn't afford a plane ticket. And those days there were ships flying between Chennai and Penang. Mm. Penang is in Malaysia. And so my dad gave me just enough money to go to Chennai and take a ship, you see. And so I came to Chennai, and the ship was not due to leave like in another 10 days or so. So I thought, hey, what can I see in Tamil Nadu? And, you know, I thought, yeah, this place, Oroville, you know, by Aurobindo is there somewhere. I might as well go and take a look. You know, so I went to, I found a place by the beach near Oroville, and I stayed there, and I got a bicycle, and I rode around, and I saw that there's something here. You know, because I'd worked with the Institute of Cultural Affairs as an NGO, I was always very interested in communal living. This was my thing, you know. I have this love for communal living, community living. And you know, I thought, yeah, it looks like, you know, they're up to something here. But, but of course, I had to go back home, you know. And then later on, many years later, actually, you know, I met Priya, who runs this farm, this Buddha garden, in Malaysia. She was working there with her husband. Her husband was a teacher at a local school. They came from Britain, and you know, Malaysia had a lot of expatriate teachers at that time. So we became friends, and I knew her, and so she loves to write letters. I always used to get some mail from her and kind of kept touch with what she was going. And she, after being in Malaysia, she came to India because her husband got a job here. And she kept writing to us, and her husband, unfortunately, was killed. Well, he died in India. And she eventually came to settle down here in Oroville. So I thought, oh, that's interesting, you know, maybe I'll get to visit Priya one day, you know, see what she's up to. And, you know, of course, my life kind of went down. I got married and I got children and, you know, I developed in my career, you know. So I came here last year in March and, you know, I was really impressed. Well, you know, that goes back to my, you know, sense of communal living, mm-hmm. which I really like. And it was great here because I saw that people of many different nationalities were living here and they had this theme of unity, which, you know, it's like, catchword these days, isn't it? I mean, unity, everybody's talking about oneness. I don't know if you've heard of this. A lot of gurus, you know, spiritual leaders, teachers, all these people are talking about oneness nowadays. Even scientists, they're talking about oneness. I believe there's something of real value there. And I think Oroville has made a start in it very much earlier than a lot of people thought about these kind of things, you know. I mean, they started in 1968, right? Mm-hmm. There was never boundaries, you know, when there were indigenous people living in this planet, right? You know? So we have to drop all these things. I don't know, probably, you know, there might be a future, but you never know, you know, anything can come by and, you know, there might be a positive trend, and you know, but there's always a negative trend which may come to oppose that. So it's kind of a flow, you know. Just go with the flow, I suppose. I really don't know, you know, but of course everybody would like to see a better world, but you have to live in it, you know.
So what for you personally makes you want to live close to the land?
You know, I live in a city and there's always a smog over Kuala Lumpur where I live. Mm-hmm. It's because of all the pollution, all the motor cars and, you know, the kind of landscape where air currents are not so swift that they don't blow the pollution away, so the smog hangs over the city all the time. It's just horrible, you know. It makes me real sick. I, you know, sometimes I have this allergies, breathing, you know, sinus problems. I do wonder, you know, whether it's because of the air and stuff like that. But so I like a greener environment where the air is fresher and, you know, you can take a deep breath, you know, and really fill your lungs with all the oxygen, you know, which is coming from the trees. You know, you don't get that in the cities. Mm. And that's what I like. It makes me feel healthier, you know. You know, I get to do work, physical work, you know. If I'm in the city, I don't get to do so much physical work. You know, I like that fact that we can walk a lot, you know. And, you know, you can relate with people living close by and in a community kind of way, you know, not like in an urban area where, you know, you just go to work and come back home and then you're in your house and you're watching TV, or, you know, on the internet. Or, you know, don't relate that much with the neighborhood, you know.
Yeah.
And Like in Malaysia, there's not much of a community spirit, and because of all these divisions which I'm talking about, people don't get together as much. Although, you know, the catchword in Malaysia is integration. You know, they have a new policy by the government. They call it One Malaysia, which is really a sham. You know, it's there as a government policy, but it's not. The government itself does not practice it at all. So I, in a way, it's an escape for me because I can't do anything about that.
Right.
So I'd rather come to a community which has some of these kind of ideals in mind. When I came here in 1978, I really didn't get a chance to see very much. I just cycled around here, and I looked for people to talk to, and I didn't find anybody. And I only knew about Auroville from the writings of what I'd read, you know, whatever I could find at that time about the vision of Auroville. And so I didn't really. But what I noticed was that in that time, in 1978, it was very barren here. There's a lot of short grass and a lot of grassy places. Not many trees, but it looked like, you know, there was jungle here now, you know, when I came back last year. So it certainly is, you know, has been transformed over that period of 30 years or whatever, you know, since I was here.
Do you think that overall, moving and being in those cities where you are so separate and isolated, that affects the human psyche in a negative way? Do you see a difference in the people that are in the cities compared to the people that not necessarily in this community but have a more rural lifestyle or community-based lifestyle?
There is a difference, yes. But I wouldn't say that it is negative altogether, you know. I mean, people are people, you know, and they respond to, you know, the stimulus around them. And whatever information is fed to them, however way the parents are raising them. So whether it's urban or rural or, you know, in a community, you know, they still respond in their own way. And some of them respond positively, some of them negatively. You can't escape from the fact that, you know, there are huge metropolises all over the world, and they are going to exist for your whole lifetime, and you know, it's practically impossible to undo that. I mean, and you know, the whole world's economy, the commerce, everything is based on urban living, isn't it? You know, so perhaps people within urban areas should look into how they could have urban communities, which I think is feasible. You know. Mm-hmm. When I worked with the Institute of Cultural Affairs, the NGO, they actually started with the urban community. So, you know, they were not like rural-based community development. And they started in a place called Fifth City in Chicago. And it was a huge success, you know. They demonstrated that, you know, developing the community spirit in an urban area is possible as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, you know, it needs much more, you know, strength and resolve and action in an urban area to get people, you know, to live in a community kind of spirit and develop that compared to, you know, more rural setting, you know. A lot of people have little plots of land in their homes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they could do their own gardening in their own homes in that plot of land, you know, and that would, you know, give them some produce for their kitchens, you know, vegetables or whatever. They can even have, I don't know if they could have chickens in their backyard to have eggs or whatever. But, you know, that's a possibility. And it would enhance the country, you know, their country's productivity if they could spend, and also they would get a bit of physical exercise working in their gardens. That, in fact, I had been talking with a friend of mine, a couple of friends about this in Malaysia, trying to get that going, and a few of us are kind of like working on that, you know, starting groups of people, you know, active and urging their neighbors to, you know, plant their gardens and give out seeds. The NGO I was with, ICA, they used to do community meetings. regularly, where, you know, the community gets together to discuss issues, things like that. You know, it's like in a free democratic spirit where people could speak and say what they want. Lots of things, actually, you know, because, and I'm sure the research and the work has been done. Thus, there are hundreds of NGOs around the world who are involved in this. And you just have to do a little bit of looking around, you know, there's people doing that all over the world. Mm. Yeah.
Can you think of anything else that you'd want to share?
About Oroville?
Yeah, about Oroville.
There's hope. I think that, yeah. And sometimes we are swamped with so much of negative information and, you know. But by looking at Oroville, I feel there is hope. At one time, I told you that I used to read a lot about all the spiritual masters. It tends to be a bit confusing when you read too much, you know, and you read too many masters, too many gurus. I'd say just drop the whole lot, you know. Just go with your feelings and go with your heart. And I believe that hope is important. And I love the fact that, you know, there's what, 140 different countries here, people from 140 different. And I heard there's not a single Malaysian who's become an Orovillian. Like, maybe I can become the first one.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
Possibility, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah. And, you know, like Sadhana Forest, that community, and I'm really inspired by them because, you know, they even expanded, they've gone out to Haiti and doing a
right.
community there. You see, that's what my work with the NGO, I really loved being, incidentally, although I got ill there, I really loved, I mean, that was, I think, the best 4 years of my life with that organization. And, you know, we always, in that organization, we always talked about replicating what we do, you know. If we do something, it should be replicable. And in other words, whatever is done, you should be able to do it somewhere else, you know.
Yes.
And, and Sadhana Forest looks like, you know, they're trying to do that, to replicate what they're doing. But of course, you know, based on the needs of that local area, wherever they're working at, you know.
Right. That seems to me, I think of Oroville more as philosophy or an idea.
Yeah.
And this is the physical form of it, but
sure.
It could also be implemented or passed on around the world. And you could just, you know, as Sadhana Forest is opening that, you know, almost a branch of it in Haiti, but continue to pop them up and
sure.
just keep it spreading. And that's what needs to happen more than just continuing to base and put all the effort into just one community.
Yeah. Yeah. And it looks like they're expanding pretty fast.
Yeah.
You know? And there's people who are really like gung-ho to go, you know, ready to go, you know, to work in very difficult conditions. And that's the spirit of adventure for me. You know, to have something new to look forward to every day to do.